aside for a moment the seven piercing and eight breaking through, what about acting independently of words and logic? See the following. Nansen, Kisu, and Meyoku were on their way together to pay their respects to Chu Kokushi. When they were halfway there, Nansen drew a circle on the ground and said, "If you can say a word, I will go on with you." Kisu sat down in the middle of the circle. Meyoku, saying this, made a curtsy. Nansen said, "Then I will not go." Kisu said, "What an attitude of mine." Yuki's arrow, Secho's verse, Yuki's arrow shot the monkey. How straight it flew, circling the tree. Out of thousands, even tens of thousands, how many have hit the mark? Come, let's go home together. No need to pay respects to Soke. But again, why not? Isn't it a smooth road to Soke? Sorry to say, it's day three of our session. I'm sorry because I can't believe it's already day three. Not everybody may be sorry. I understand. Not been there. But I don't know about you, but I just couldn't sleep last night, you know. At the end of sitting, you know, I had so much energy. It was like, honestly, this happens to me sometimes, you know, you think, okay, it's the end of day two, we've all been working hard, I'm going to lie down, and it's just, as I was walking around, I just felt this pulsating energy, and I lay on the bed, it was like every atom of my being was pulsing with energy. And also, I was very excited about the moon last night. I don't know if you noticed when you were leaving the Zendo, but the moon was out. And I don't know if it's a full moon, but it was quite close to being a full moon. And it was just brilliant in the sky. And I noticed it, and you know, I'm not an astronomer, but it's quite amazing, isn't it? The moon is always shining like that. We just can't see it sometimes. You know? I just think that's amazing. It's not much of a thought, you know, it's not very complicated. But seeing that moon and this sitting all day, I just lay in my bed. It was like every atom of my being was just a pulsing with life energy. It was really beautiful, really wonderful. And I know that, you know, maybe that wasn't the case for you last night. But it will be if you keep practicing. I swear to you, it will be, you know. I can remember many sesshin where, you know, it was like I ran to the bed at the end of the day and just dove into bed and probably was asleep before I even hit the bed. And, I mean, really. And then the next thing you know, there's some guy clacking those clackers. It's like, what? Like 4:30? You know, it can't be. I just, you know, closed my eyes. And I can remember a session where, you know, it takes a while to, you know, you try to stand up and your legs are sore. And I can remember sesshin where I was going off to the bunkhouse with my teeth chattering, you know. With, I don't know, was it pain or was it energy? So hard to tell, you know. They're very close to one another. But, you know, at some point, you know, it just turns around. It doesn't happen all at once, but, you know, probably in, for some people here, you know, the last evening before we go home is probably going to have a hard time sleeping. We're going to have so much life energy. And if that doesn't happen this time, you know, it's definitely going to happen. You know, just hang in there. And, you know, don't worry too much about results. Just be present. This is a wonderful koan. Nansen is later to become the teacher of Zhaozhu, of Joshu. Kisu and Meyoku, all Dharma contemporaries, brothers, were on their way to pay their respects to Chu Kokushi. When they were halfway there, Nansen drew a circle on the ground and said, "If you can say a word, I will go on with you." Now this is like classic Zen, right? There's so many of these stories. Last Saturday, I talked about the koan of Gu Tei's one finger. And it begins with in the Chinese version, from the transmission of the lamp, of the light. It begins with a nun who comes into the temple, into Gu Tei's temple, where he's the abbot, and challenges him. She says, "If you can say one word of Zen, you can show me one example of your mental condition, of an awakened mind. You can show me an awakened mind, I'll stay." And she walks around Gu Tei three times, and he can't show her awakened mind. And so she leaves, and he's devastated. And in this case, too, we've got Nansen, Kisu, and Meyoku. They're on their way to pay their respects to Chu Kokushi. And on their way to pay respects because he's just died. And they're halfway there, and Nansen drew a circle on the ground and said, "If you can say a word, if you can show me enlightened mind, I'll go on with you." So Kisu sat down in the middle of the circle after Nansen draws it on the ground. And Meyoku, seeing this, makes a curtsy like a lady in the old days, you know. Ladies used to take their skirt and curtsy, right? And Nansen says, "Fine, I won't even go." And Kisu sees him going away and says, what an attitude of mind. What a response. What a rascal. What a rogue. So the question is, you know, have they done the right, have they made the right answer or not? Have they made the right answer or not? You know, how do you know when you have the right answer? You know, first of all, they don't do the same thing. You know, so it is true sometimes that different people are going to experience reality differently. For example, the experience of awakening itself can be quite different for different people. One person described it as like the moon in the sky, you know. Another person said it's like an iron ball falling at a million miles an hour through a dark shaft. You know, believe it or not, same experience, different description, different description. So there is this kind of variability to some degree. Why it might take a little while for the teacher to assess what you've said. So when you come into the Dokusan room, there is a kind of a answer teacher's looking for. And it's not, quote unquote, all subjective, right? But there are variations in how a person might present the answer. Also, you know, you should know that koans have many aspects. So, for example, well, koan is like a big elephant. And somebody can come in and say, it's got a tail. You say, okay, good. Somebody can come in and say, it's got a trunk. Somebody can come in and say, it's got a big ear. And the teacher is, the teacher decides maybe at some point, well, you've seen enough of the elephant, that's good. Or maybe, you know, you've seen a lot of the elephant. Sometimes somebody comes in and says, it's an elephant. You go, wow, great. But that's not always possible. So somebody comes in and says, it's an ear, you might say, good. Now please go on and see if there's anything else. And sometimes people are stumped by that because they'll come back and say, well, this doesn't make any sense at all. I thought it was an ear and now it's a snake. You know, keep looking, please. You know, keep looking. But it's like that, you know. If you want to understand what Zen is all about, it's experiencing reality. And people think they experience reality every day, but their experience of reality is highly obstructed by all kinds of factors. You know, it's actually very, very, very difficult for human beings to experience the real. Even though they think they're in the real all the time, it's actually extremely difficult for people to experience the real because, first of all, we're afraid of being hurt. You know, this is like number one. I mean, I've never forgotten it, so it left quite an impression on me, but I remember when I was a boy, my parents were moving from Baltimore, Fairfax, Virginia, to Baltimore. As you know, Baltimore would turn out to be like a difficult chapter in my life. But they were packing everything up, and there was a lamp sitting on the table, and the lamp no longer had a bulb in it. And I was at the age where everything looked interesting, so I was studying this device, and I looked inside, and I just thought, what the heck? You know, you look inside the socket where the bulb should be, and you see this little metal disc at the bottom in this cardboard socket, you know, metal. I think, what the heck is that? You know, maybe I'll just touch it, you know? And I looked up, and my mother said, don't touch it, you know?
Boom!
You know? And this is like life, right? You know, this is life. So, you know, we're afraid. You get your new bicycle. You want your new bicycle. You get your bicycle. You get on your bicycle and you knock yourself cold. This actually happened to me. You know? I had one of these little kids' bicycles. This was in Baltimore. And it was humiliating, right? It was for little kids. And all these kids who used to beat me up, for some reason I wanted to impress them. So I wanted a real bike, right? And then, of course, I had to fight to defend my real bike. So my father got me a Columbia bike. I don't know if Columbia's still in business or not, but it was this big, it was like the bike on Pee-wee's Big Adventure. You know, it had a big, heavy bike, one gear. You know, you could stand on the pedals when you went uphill. And I got on it, and I didn't want training wheels because that's what little kids had. And my father started pushing me down the street, and I was thinking, wow, this is fantastic. And I remember, I said, keep pushing, you know, and I looked and I realized he was far away, you know, and then I looked back, but it was too late, I crashed, you know. And next thing, I don't remember crashing, to tell you the truth. I remember getting on a new bike and then the next thing I do remember is being on the couch and my mother was putting a cold compress on my head, and I had this giant scab on my forehead for a couple of weeks. You know. So after that, you know, your bike is not the same. You know, we have these experiences where, you know, we extend trust to life and we get burned, and sometimes that we get really hurt, you know. So it becomes very difficult to move forward into the future. Yeah? It's very difficult to go from moment to moment and to see what's real. Because we're so afraid it's going to hurt us. This is incredibly powerful, human motivation. And much of human behavior can be explained in terms of this desire to avoid possible pain from life. I think really if you want to understand the modern world, it's like it's really like a revolt against life in a way. And its goal is to avoid pain. You know, we construct a society which is really organized to minimize suffering and pain and maximize pleasure. This is actually what the people who created the modern world actually said society should do. That maximize pleasure, minimize pain. Now, the interesting thing is that I think modern world has many good achievements, like medicine, very important, you know, popular education, you need, you know, mass culture to have that. You know, I have a car. I assume most people have cars. But all the same, even though these are wonderful inventions, you know, we really have created this world where we try to stay out of pain all the time. And it has taken on slightly an insane quality, I think. You know, because we wind up getting very cut off from life in general. And the interesting thing to me is that it hasn't worked very well. You know, I was reading this statistic the other day, and it said something like half of all American adults are on antidepressant type medication. Maybe it wasn't quite half, but it was a huge percentage. And I thought that's the darndest thing, you know, when you think about how much time we spend trying to enjoy ourselves and be safely happy, and yet so many people are anxious and unhappy. I just think that's interesting. And you know, it has to do with this element of not trusting life, which is caused by experiences that hurt us. And so we really have a hard time seeing the real. You know, it takes great effort to see the real. And we have to really overcome this fear. And then we also have to move aside all of these curtains we have drawn around the world in order to protect ourselves, keep us from feeling pain. You know, we have no air conditioning today. And it's rough, right? You know, the kitchen is especially hot, but it's all hot, you know. And we sit in here and it can be very hot, especially earlier it was very humid. And it's hot and it's humid, it's sort of like a pressure cooker, you know. And the air conditioner is right over there, you know, I can see it when I sit. Should I turn it on? But if we turn it on, you know, we won't be able to hear the crickets anymore, you know. And it's true, we won't be able to hear the dump trucks or whatever, you know, which make a clanging noise, you know, the guys on their motorcycles. So it's like, you know, we'll have like a safe environment with sort of like a droning hum, sort of neutral hum, but no crickets anymore. So we're comfortable, but no crickets, you know. So it's like we lose something to get that comfort level. And it's a shame because, you know, yesterday we were sitting and we were listening to the Katy Dids, and You know, we weren't trying to have a beautiful experience. We weren't trying to have any particular kind of experience. You just turn around and you hear it. You know, it's like that incredible sound. All those hundreds, maybe thousands of insects all making this sound at the same time. It's really extraordinary. It's like, this is our life. You know, this is eternity, isn't it? This is time and it's eternity. You know, this is our life. You know, at least in the present form, we're not going to get another one. You know, so suddenly, you know, we sit on the cushion, it's hot, we're sweaty, it's steamy. You come in, you think, oh no, another sit. You know, my legs are killing me. And then suddenly, that wave of sound, and sometimes it can just catch you. It's so beautiful. It's like, this is eternity. This is my true self. You know, this is where I'll be forever and ever and ever. You know, and then it goes, and the moment's gone, you know. But for a second there, it's just really something, isn't it? But we're trying to have an experience. It just happens. You know, leaving the zendo, you suddenly look up, there's the moon. You know, it's like, wow, clouds, moon, you know, maybe breeze on your face, it's just like, oh, this is like eternity. So beautiful. Now this is a different kind of life. See, it's really encountering reality. And it becomes possible to encounter reality when we can get beyond our fear, including the fear of pain, and when we can get beyond the veils of the illusion of ignorance that have been drawn around us. You know, but it's so hard to know, you know, what the real is because, you know, we have this cultural conditioning and personal conditioning. You know, people in my mother's generation, women in my mother's generation, had really been told this is what a woman is supposed to be. You know, my mother really wanted to be a lawyer. You know, she really wanted to be, she eventually became a legal stenographer. But her father wasn't a very well-educated person, and he just thought the idea of women going to college was ridiculous. And so, you know, he never helped my mother to go to college, and she sort of lost her, she didn't have the money. So she eventually got as close to the legal profession as she could. She became a court reporter. And she loved it. My mother was consumed by the law, but she never got to be a lawyer. And so many women experience that, you know. In other words, they grew up and somebody said, you're a woman, here is what you are, here is how you're supposed to, you know. Women do this, but they don't do that, you know. And, you know, when women ask themselves, why am I so unhappy? Why do I feel so empty? The answer wasn't obvious to them, you know. So they had to set off on a long journey, and encountering barriers is really how you discover what reality is. You know, you come up against a barrier, and then it forces you to sort of it forces you to change and to grow. And so these barriers are so important. It's really the only way we can get out of our conditioning. You know, and so, you know, one day somebody realized, my mother realized, you know, I might not be able to go to law school right now, but I could still work in a courthouse. You know, it was hard at that time, even being a legal even being a court reporter was a sort of male domain. So my mother encountered a lot of rebuffs trying to get into the legal system in the little town in upstate New York where she lived. in Plattsburgh. But she became an excellent legal secretary and a legal assistant, and then she became a court stenographer and court reporter and worked with judges, and she earned their respect, but she never knew what she was doing. See, she never knew what she was doing. It was all kind of blundering on. Because she didn't start out thinking, oh, I could be a lawyer too. In fact, that was something she too had always been told, women don't become lawyers, you know. So you have to sort of blunder on in life. This is how you really discover who you really are, what your true nature is, you know. Somebody can say, this is what you're supposed to be. And you can say, yes, Dad, that's what I'll be. Yes, Mom, that's what I'll be. And then you can try to, you know, stay on that road. But at some point, somebody might say, you know, I just don't like this. I'm not happy. I'm not alive. And then you get off the road and you can make mistakes. You know, you can make some big mistakes. And you take some risks and you try this and you fail and you try that and you succeed. And you might decide your failures are more interesting than your successes, you know? But all the time you're going through this process, you begin to feel more alive. And if you can overcome your fear, you know, you can really have some wonderful experiences. When I was in college, my father completely disapproved of everything I did, just about. He wanted me to be an officer in the State Department. He wanted me to go into the Foreign Service, basically. He was a Navy man, and all of his people he worked with, who he respected, were in the Foreign Service, and they were all like really good students, and they knew languages, and they were cultured and urbane. And my dad grew up in East Orange, New Jersey, so he never felt like he was cultured and urbane. So meanwhile, I was reading Jack Kerouac books, you know, and I wanted to be a beatnik. And that must have been really heartbreaking for my dad, because I used to dress like a hippie. You know, I would come home and I would take off my boots, and I didn't have any socks on sometimes. And my father just used to look at, he used to say, Kurt, you're just a crud. You know? and it hurt him, you know. He wanted me to be like David Niven or something, you know. Somebody very, I don't know, you guys don't know David Niven. very polished. Yeah. I don't know who that would be now, you know. But the thing is, you know, I just couldn't be that. My energy was pulling me in another direction. And, I decided I wanted to take some time off and explore. And my father just said, you know, you've got to go to graduate school. You've got to have a plan. You know, what's the plan? What's the plan? And by the way, my father loved me a great deal and really wanted the best for me. But he didn't know what my best was, did he? You know, so anyway, I read this book called On the Road by Jack Kerouac, and I wanted to go on the road. So my good friend Larry Sullivan and I actually we both read the book. We read, you know, it's like the manual of how to hitchhike across the United States. So we got backpacks, and we decided we were going to go out west and backpack. We had been backpacking on the Appalachian Trail. And we just decided we were going to take a year off and just backpack and hitchhike. And we hitchhiked all the way across the United States from Washington, D.C. to Seattle, Washington. And then eventually we wound up in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And it was an incredible experience. But, you know, some of it we did together and some of it we did by ourselves. Individually. Now, let me just say that I really would recommend not hitchhiking. You know, really and truly, that's not like the parental voice. It's just the world has really changed in 30 years. My wife and I used to hitchhike, and we were perfectly safe. But I think it's a very different world now, and I really wouldn't recommend doing it. But it was wonderful at the time. But when I was hitchhiking by myself, though, I have to tell you, I felt I would have mornings where I would get up, and I would be really fearful. I would think to myself, what am I doing with my life? You know, I'm really just a bum. I'm becoming a bum, you know. When I would run out of money during this period, which wound up being several years, you know, I would work in restaurants, I'd work for a moving company, and, you know, I would hear my father's voice saying, you know, you're a bum, you're a bum, you're a crud, you're a bum, you're a crud. And, you know, I would sometimes think, what the heck am I doing? You know, I'm throwing my life away or something like that. But you know, all those doubts and all those fears, and sometimes I was just afraid because I would be hitchhiking by the side of the road thinking, you know, what am I, you know, this is such a weird thing. You know, this is so, I'm begging people for rides and, you know, I have $500 in the bank and that's it. And, you know, I haven't looked for a job in a year, you know. And I wouldn't recommend that to everybody because it wasn't everybody's path. But, you know, I remember going to the Grand Canyon, you know, for the first time, and it was just mind-blowing, right? You know, it was just mind-blowing. And I went down the Grand Canyon, and I'll never forget it. You know, and I went to Zion Park and Pecos Wilderness, and when I hooked up with Larry, we would go up into the mountains, and we'd go for 2 weeks until we ran out of food and had to come back and get some more food. It was just wonderful. But all this time, I felt like I was just blundering along. You know, it wasn't like I knew the happy ending was coming. And the thing that kept me going was this tremendous sense of being alive, and in spite of my fear and is, you know, some physical discomfort. You know, if you hike, you know, your muscles get very tired. But you know, I just felt like my life was opening up. You know, and this is the life. This is like the life of Zen, the life in Zen. You know, people might say we're crazy to be doing this. You know, no air conditioning? You're crazy. Or getting up at 4:30, you know, and maybe there's a voice in your head, the voice of somebody saying, this is nuts, you know, this is a cult, this is whatever. But, you know, at some time during the day, you know, you may feel, you know, more alive. You know, that incredible sense of being alive. And then you know you're on the right path, even if you're not answering your koan, even if your legs hurt, you know, even if you're, you know, it's interesting, isn't it? You can fail and still be happy and still feel alive. And that's the most amazing thing. You know, it's really an amazing thing. You can fail and fail and fail, but your deeper self is plugged right in, is connected, you know? And the little mind says, gee, I'm not answering my koan. And I've been working on this koan for 3 months. I've got to get somewhere, or I'm a Zen failure, you know? And this is my life. I've embraced this as my life, but now I'm not even answering my koans, you know? And yet, you know, you sit there on the cushion sometimes and you just feel so alive. And there's this split, you know, but little by little you just stop listening to the small self. And there's this wonderful life that's a whole being, body, mind, and heart, comes alive. And it's endless in all directions because it's the katydids, it's the moon, it's the sound of a motorcycle. It's all one big life, yeah? And the little mind is always unhappy, as a matter of fact. Always. Oh, is unhappy ought to be called little unhappy mind. I was just reading this article by this guy, John Gertner, who was a journalist. And he was interviewing a bunch of psychologists, and they've been doing studies on happiness. And the amazing thing is that most people are incredibly bad at predicting what will make them happy. I mean, the statistics are astonishing. So, you know, the results are really deep. You know, you say, what would make you happy? Promotion, you know, fun. And then people get it and they're miserable, you know. And the psychologist that Gertner interviewed said, you know, human beings are really just terrible predictors of what will make them happy. That they just generally do what people have told them they should do. And they win the lottery, they you know, get the promotion, they become a celebrity, and the life is not any better, it's actually worse. And so somebody, Gertner said to these psychologists, so what do you think we should do? And he said, you know, you just have to go with the flow, that sort of thing. You know, you're more likely to hit it by chance. And I think what he really meant was, you know, they don't have a, psychologists don't yet have a concept of the big mind or true self. But, you know, the big mind, the true self, is a better guide to these things. So how do you know when it's the right answer? You know it's the right answer because your body, mind, and heart are full of life. You know, sometimes you just know. My sister-in-law is a painter. And I actually think she's one of the best painters I've met. And I love her work, a lot of it anyway. There's some of the work I don't like, but some of it I don't like. The squiggly stuff, I could take or leave. But she doesn't always do squiggly stuff. She also does, you know, like paintings of birds and things like that. And I just love them. And I've known her for about 30 years, you know. And I've seen her have shows, and you know, some of her stuff sells and some of it doesn't, you know. And she's actually been very true to her art. You know, she's really been a good servant of her true self. And she's had a difficult life. You know, she works in a kind of a halfway house, a little bit like Carlos. You know, our friend Carlos isn't here because he's at this very difficult job now, and he's working in a kind of a halfway house situation. And these are people who are on their way out of restraint. And so, you know, Sydney has to work at night, right, which is statistically shortens your life, isn't it? So she has this very difficult work situation, and it's not always possible for her to do as much with her art as she wants, and she tries to work as little as she can and still make her art. And but when I see her working, or when we talk about what she's doing, you know, the joy and the energy, you know, it's so clear this is the life she should have lived. You know, it's just so clear. You know, and it's not a conventionally happy life. You know, but she's so alive. You know, when she's talking about what she's doing, you know, when you look at the work in progress, and they're just radiant energy. You know, there's a difference between happiness and joy. You know, it's just joy, joy. You can be unhappy and joyful. You know, little mind's unhappy, but big mind is full of joy. You know, same thing with pain. You know. There's pain and there's suffering. You know, when we sit in pain, we can suffer. But if we enter deep samadhi, deep mushin, this pain is still there, but no longer suffering. Because now we're in big mind. See, it's only little mind that suffers. bodies have pain, but the big mind doesn't suffer. Little mind suffers. So, you know, this is the path. If this is your path, you know, don't waste time in doubts and arguments, you know, that have nothing to do with this. You shoot your arrow and wherever it goes is A-OK, right? Wherever it goes is A-OK. You know, we want it to go into that target. It would be better, you know, the best archer is not the one who hits the target, it's the one who paints a bullseye around the arrow wherever it lands. Surefire. This is the Zen approach, right? You can't miss. That's how you play. And this is so important. I don't know why my true self made me get up today at 4:30, but I'm so happy. I'm so full of joy. You know, I don't know why, you know, I get up every day at 4:30 and sit. I could be doing other things, but when I do it, I have so much joy. And this is, you know, just follow the energy. Follow the energy. And the arrow is going somewhere interesting. You know, so just go and look. See where, you know, see where it's taking you. It's a real adventure. It's like hitchhiking. You just get on the road, you stick out your hand, you don't know who's going to pick you up. Could be 50 miles, could be all the way to California. And the guy could be psycho. He could have you home for dinner with his family. You know, could be, you know, you could get in and it's Dan Rather. You know, so if you want to get into the media, you know, so okay, sure. Life-changing opportunity, you just never know. But this is what Zen is all about. And a lot of you are there and you don't even know it. You know, so, you know, people say to me, I just can't focus, I can't sit. So you say, well, let's give it a try. And so, what's happening in your mind? Look at your mind. You see? Nothing. It's like, see, that is the face of Buddha. You can say, well, it's just blank. It's nothing. But just stay with it. Stay with it. You know, if you go to the Grand Canyon in the tour bus, you know, when I was going to the Grand Canyon, they bring the tour buses in, right? And the air-conditioned tour bus. And it's full of people, and they look out at the Grand Canyon, and the guy says, come on out. And they come on out and they walk to the edge. Yeah, that's really grand, really big. And back in the bus onto, you know, Yosemite or something. That's one way to live. You know, and now, if you're seeing that blankness, that darkness, that is the Grand Canyon. But you're just maybe right now looking at it from the bus, you know. So, you know, So the good news is you're there. Not your arrow has landed right in the target, and it's not as hard as you make as your little mind makes it out to be. Don't listen to that chattering idiot. You know, you're already there. In five breaths, mind is blank and dark. And by the way, the ability to do that takes years of practice. You know, we don't appreciate how much we've achieved, but if you can do that, that's taken hundreds of hours of sitting to achieve. That kind of mental stability is extraordinary. You know, not one in 1,000 people has that mental control. Not one in 10,000 people. So don't sell yourself short. You know, it's taken a lot to get there. And the good news is that if you're there, you're really there. And so you know, working with the Wu Koan, once you're at that point, is like now you're off the bus, you're at the right place, you're going to go down into the canyon, you know. And there's many, you can go down, you can go to the right, you can take the trail down to the first spring, and you can stop there and you can come back. Or you can go all the way down to the bottom at the Colorado River, you know, and it's a very difficult journey in some ways and incredibly rewarding. And you can come back. Or you can go down there, you can make that your home, right? Which is, I think, the best of all. So, you know, if you're seeing, if you're calling five breaths, five moves and it's blank, it's not so hard. And just keep going back to that blindness. And it's like going into the canyon, down, down, down. And a really amazing transformation is in store. You know, just have no expectation. So. Yuki's arrow shot the monkey. Arrow shot the monkey. How straight it flew, circling the tree. This is the real arrow, right? Our arrows go where they want to go. Big mind's arrow. Out of thousands, even tens of thousands, how many have hit the mark? Come, let us go home together to that beautiful machine. No need to pay respects to Soke. But again, why not? Isn't it a smooth road to Soke? Isn't it? It's beautiful. This, you know, it seems so frightening, so difficult, so hard. But then you look back and it's been like the royal road, right? Perfect. Every step has been perfect. All the way forward, it's terrifying. And then you look back and it's like golden world. Every step has been perfect. Every moment has been perfect. And why? It's like so afraid.